This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Boy, there's a lot going on. A couple of news stories also that I want to let you know about. Right at this moment, as we speak, they're voting on the various amendments to the, they call it the Protect America Act. They really should call it the Protect George Bush and His Buddies Act, Protect the Telecom Companies Act. It essentially, the big crime with this piece of legislation, and I think this is a terrible piece of legislation, and I have called my senator's offices, and I encourage others to do the same. Just dump this thing. First of all, it's 6 years, not 6 months, and it really should be 6 months. And secondly, it essentially shifts the power to make decisions about wiretapping from the judiciary, which is where it is placed in the Constitution. You have to go before a court to get a warrant before you can spy on somebody, from the judiciary into the hands of the executive branch. In other words, the president. This is Richard Nixon's dream on steroids. And there have been a number of attempts to amend it in ways that might poison pill it so that Bush would veto it, or that would kind of clean it up a little bit. But still, it's trying to put lipstick on a pig. It's a terrible piece of legislation. And if you want to call your U.S. senators, callcongress.org is the phone number. So I'll leave it at that. A lot of conversation, a lot of discussion about David Schuster and his comment about Hillary Clinton's daughter, Chelsea Clinton, and this whole pimping out comment. And I stayed out of this yesterday because I thought, you know, there's really a much bigger issue here. And, you know, I figured it would probably, you know, let the small stuff blow over. And it hasn't. And for, you know, probably good reason, in that when a campaign is given something that they can use to get publicity, obviously they're going to use it as much as they can to get publicity. You know, arguably the whole thing about, you know, some of the comments that Bill Clinton made were used by the Obama campaign in this way. Now this is being used by the Clinton campaign in this way. You know, let's try and move the story on. But to the larger issue, David Schuster's big mistake was in pimping out himself. And that's the issue that nobody's talking about. That's the issue that the mainstream media won't talk about, because that shows the corruption of the mainstream media. The bottom line here is that we no longer have news. There used to be this clear definition between news reporters and commentators. I'm a commentator. I'm not a news reporter. I did news for 7 years back in the 1970s. Back then, I knew I was not to have an opinion. In fact, that was back before Reagan did away with the Fairness Doctrine, and the radio station that I was working on was required to run a news department that actually lost money for the radio station in order to keep their license. And it was, and all of the television networks ran news divisions that lost money. But that news programming that those television networks were running was the content that the content that the local stations could carry. And thus say, at the end of the year, when they talked to the FCC and said, please renew our license, they say, here's the public service that we were performing. We did news. And so it used to be a very clear thing. Here are the news people. Here are the commentary people. They're different. And David Schuster is a reporter. And he was asked, essentially, to be a commentator. And, you know, this is the crime. You know, crime is perhaps too strong a word in the context of David Schuster himself. But, you know, the bigger issue here is that, where did our news go? When did we become all infotainment all the time, when we're asking news people to play the role of commentators, and we're asking commentators to provide news, where we've got an entire, you know, large segment of the population, in large part a new generation coming up, that's getting its news from comedy shows? Not that I'm, you know, I mean, I love The Daily Show and I love Stephen Colbert. They're great programs. But should they be the sole source of news for large chunks of our population? I'm frankly, you know, very concerned about this. And this whole issue of infotainment is, in my opinion, the real issue here. It's not whether David Schuster should be fired or not, or whether he should have apologized. You know, obviously the guy was groveling. He's concerned about his job. He stepped out of line. But where he stepped out of line, in my opinion, was by trying to play analyst when he's a reporter. And in fact, I'd put it even in a larger frame. I'd say the person who asked him to play analyst stepped out of line because they asked him to go beyond his own role. And the network that set this thing up, and the frame and the show that set this thing up, stepped out of line because they're constantly doing this. I mean, what happened even in recent past? I guess I'm mourning the loss of CNN headline news. You know, it used to be that if you woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you couldn't get to sleep. You could turn on the news and see what was going on. Now you get Nancy Grace. So you get a commentator pretending to do the news, or Glenn Beck, an opinion, a talk radio host pretending to do the news, or actually not even pretending, offering commentary on a channel that's representing itself as news. It's the problem, obviously, with Fox News. You know, they call it fair and balanced. We're news. No, I'm sorry. It's not news. And it's not fair and balanced. And everybody knows it. We really need to consider, I mean, these two major changes. In 87, Reagan saying, okay, let's blow away the Fairness Doctrine. And all those parts of it that were associated with it that said that radio and television stations holding the airwaves as a public trust have to provide a public service. They have to provide meaningful information. They have to provide genuine news. It may be boring. It may not pull the highest ratings like, you know, white girls missing in Aruba. But it's necessary for democracy. There's a reason why it was put into those laws. There's a reason why it was there. And so now what we're getting is all infotainment all the time. We're getting a focus on the trivial rather than a focus on the issues. And I, you know, bottom line, I think that is the crime. I mean, you can go off on, you know, Tucker Carlson saying, you know, on MSNBC, there's just something, you're talking about Hillary Clinton, there's just something about her that feels castrating, overbearing, and scary. I've often said when she comes on television, I involuntarily cross my legs. See, this isn't, you know, now, of course, I was going to say this isn't limited to David Schuster, but here, Tucker Carlson is a guy who doesn't make any pretense of being anything other than a commentator. So he's making commentary, and you can say, hey, it's disgusting commentary. I don't like it. Well, don't listen to it. Or lobby the network to replace him with somebody else. But there needs to be this clear definition. We need to go back to the idea of having a bright line between news and entertainment. I remember when I was doing radio, and at the risk of sounding like, I remember back in the day. But the reality is, and I mean, look at history. I remember back in the 70s when I was doing news, and the sales department was not allowed to talk to us. They couldn't come in and say, you know, there's a big story involving a chemical spill, and that chemical company is one of our sponsors. Don't come in. They couldn't do that. This was the policy of the radio station. Why? Because they wanted to keep their license. And now you have entire programs, entire, quote, news programs that are filled with commentators offering commentary and infotainment that are sponsored by, oh, defense contractors. Hey, want to buy an F-14? Why would anybody advertise an F-14 on a news program? Why would they advertise oil rigs on a news program? Why would they advertise coal plants? Hey, you want to buy a $300 million coal plant? I don't think so. So why are they advertising it? Well, obviously to influence the infotainment, because it's now infotainment, and it's now influenceable. The wall has been torn down between the advertising department and the entertainment department, and the wall, and long ago, the wall between the entertainment department and the news department went. And that's what we should be mourning. That's what we should be worried about. That's what we should be concerned about. Alexis de Tocqueville, back in 1835, came over to the United States and talked about this in his book, Democracy in America. His one of the last chapters, What Sort of Despotism Democratic Nations Have to Fear. And he saw a clear and present danger, and it was precisely exactly what we're seeing right now. He said, he wrapped this chapter up, he said, an independent press that actually provides news was one of the most critical things in America. He says, I think that men living in aristocracies may, strictly speaking, do without the liberty of the press, but such is not the case with those who live in democratic countries. Servitude cannot become complete if the press is free. The press is the chief democratic instrument of freedom. So, do we have a free press? Well, how can you say that you have a free press when the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of your press is owned by a very small number of people. And now it's operating outside of these rules. I mean, you go back to this is Ben Bagdikian. It's been a while since he's written about this, but he noted that in 1984, 50 corporations dominated daily newspapers, magazines, radio, television, books, and movies. It dropped to about 20 by 1993, following Reagan's lack of merger and acquisitions and his doing away with the Fairness Doctrine. Now it's about 6 or 8 corporations. Control about 90% of everything people hear, see, and is that a free press? Is infotainment our problem? I would submit it is. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
And welcome back. Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my. And see, here's the other problem with infotainment is that a few among us will get caught up in endless discussions of, well, should Schuster be fired or not? Should he have said pimped out or not? That's not the point. The point is, how do we get our media back? How do we inform journalists that they should be journalists and not try to play commentator? You know, hopefully this is the beginning of a wake-up call. But, yeah, I mean, and look at all the big issues that are not being discussed. For example, today's Financial Times, the Financial Times of London, the lead editorial. This is arguably one of the most conservative newspapers in the world and certainly one of the most credible. Especially now that the Wall Street Journal is owned by Murdoch and is becoming politicized like Fox News, more and more people are turning to Financial Times for their news here in the United States even. But all over the world it's read. And the lead editorial, the top editorial, at the top of the page, the official voice of the editorial board of the Financial Times, headline, military tribunals are not the way. The decision by military prosecutors to seek the death penalty for 6 Guantanamo Bay prisoners looks like a final attempt to jumpstart an already failed and discredited process. It should be abandoned in favor of bringing the accused to trial by due process in U.S. federal courts. They note it is a legal failure and a spectacular political own goal. In other words, they're going to trot this thing out just in time for the elections. They say, yeah, yeah, look at this, 9-11, 9-11, 9-11. Hey, remember us, Republicans, 9-11. They talk about Sheikh Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the guy who brags that he was behind 9-11 and that he beheaded Daniel Pearl, at least brags apparently when being waterboarded. They say the case against him and some of his associates has been compromised by the circumvention of legal processes and the use of torture. Guantanamo and other lawless practices such as rendition, the kidnapping and outsourcing of torture to friendly despots is a capitulation by liberal societies and a surrender of the rule of law in the face of jihadi totalitarianism. In other words, Osama bin Laden is winning under George W. Bush. We're becoming them. The shameful collusion of the U.S. Congress. I'm quoting from the Financial Times lead editorial. The shameful collusion of the U.S. Congress in helping the administration revamp the military tribunals cannot disguise that. What they will do now is hand new propaganda triumphs to the jihadis, and they're absolutely right. We have secret trials, we allow evidence by torture, and then we put people to death as a consequence of it, and even if they're guilty, and frankly, in all probability, they are. Even if they're guilty, the message that is sent out to the jihadis, to these people who say, oh, yeah, violence is the way. Torture is the way. The rule of law, to hell with the rule of law. The message that we send to those people is, yep, you guys were right. We don't need no stinking constitution. We don't need no stinking rule of law. Where is the news media talking about this? Where is the news media talking about, you know, what's going on with the FISA vote right now and the real issues? I mean, the fact that what we're really talking about fundamentally is shifting responsibility for listening in on your phone conversations and mine, for reading your email and mine, from spying on you and me, the oversight responsibility of that away from the courts, where the Constitution placed it, where the founders of this country and the framers of the Constitution placed it, into the hands of the presidency. Whether that presidency is Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John McCain, or George W. Bush, it shouldn't be there. And that's what Congress is in the process of doing right now. Or at least the Senate. You know, where is the conversation about these real and serious issues? Here's Charles Swift. He says, this is the first time evidence used under torture has been since the Spanish Inquisition. Well, it's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's largely true. And then you got, you know, people like Max Boot, you know, the McCain campaign unofficial advisor on foreign policy, saying McCain's bellicose persona, you know, he looks like a tough guy. He's gonna go out there and take names and kick butt, right? And that's going to help us all around the world because it's going to scare the bejesus out of it. Yeah, we've seen how well it works when you try and frighten the world. Let's learn a lesson from the bad guys. You know, have you noticed that around the world, when regardless of ideology, regardless of how good or bad somebody may be, whatever the criteria may be, when people come in to poor areas and they say, we will build hospitals, we will build schools, we will help you build your infrastructure, we will feed you, that all of a sudden the people start voting for them. Even if they're whack jobs, even if they're totally nuts. When did we forget this? I mean, under the Republican Eisenhower administration, we were doing this. Under the Republican Nixon administration, we were doing this. We were reaching out to the world and saying, you know, we're good citizens. We're here to help you. We're going to help you build a democratic society. We're going to help you build a modern society. We're going to bring you not just liberty, not just the freedom to be unemployed like they have in Iraq, 60% unemployment, but also basic infrastructure. We're going to bring you schools that teach and hospitals that heal and water that you can actually drink. Come on. America, let's get with it here. Let's wake up to what's really going on. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our phone number, TomHartman.com for our live chat room. Stick with us.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Hello, trouble. Come on in. You talk about heartaches. Where in the world you been? I ain't had the mysteries since you've been gone. Hello, trouble, welcome home.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman radio program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Because keeping our families healthy should be a right in this country, not a privilege, and not just for the privileged few. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Phil in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Phil, what's on your mind today?
How's it going, Tom? I just wanted to say that, to pick up on what you're talking about, this infotainment, I'm a news junkie. I love current events, so I get really sucked into these shows, and I basically turn them off after 5 minutes because basically I feel like they're lazy. Their production value is where they sink all their time, and really there's no substance besides like Oberman and maybe the News Hour with Jim Lehrer. I really can't watch these shows.
Increasingly, what we're seeing is not, and increasingly, I mean, it's a two-decade trend, is just a total lack of real news and a push for infotainment.
Right, and I think one of the worst things that, like, Limbaugh and Hannity and Fox News, the biggest impact, I think, has been that they've convinced the rest of the media that basically there is a liberal media bias, so they no longer say, you know, report the facts. They feel like they have to give both sides no matter what their topic is, when really there only is one right or wrong.
And sometimes there's five or six sides.
Exactly.
But yeah, you're making a great point, Phil, and I it's an important one. Number one, this, because the gestalt of, you know, okay, well, there's one side and there's another side, let's have a debate between them. That's perfect for infotainment. That's gladiator sports. But in real news, you say, okay, there's six sides to this discussion, or there's really only one rational side to this discussion, or here's the facts and here's the opinion. You know, it's you separate it out. It's just you're absolutely right. And Fox in particular has set this up, and all the networks are looking at this, going, wow, you know, you can make money in this infotainment thing. Yes, you can. Just like you can make money in conservative talk radio or liberal talk radio or whatever it may be. These are all, however, niches. There still should be a niche called news. That just does news. And when a reporter, when a serious news reporter like David Schuster is asked his opinion about something, he should say, I'm sorry, I'm a reporter. I don't offer my opinion. I can tell you what the facts are. I can tell you what somebody else said, but I can't offer my opinion. Mike in Long Beach, California. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, hey, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. I've been a newsman since 1965. So I've seen it change gradually. I mean, even back then, the manager maybe, or the publisher, whichever, would pimp me out to do a story on a local owner of a business or something like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, basically we did objective news.
Yeah.
And recently I went...
We all had to back then.
Yeah. I went back to school recently to a community college. And to the broadcast, radio broadcast program they had there. And they had a once a week news program, which they broadcast all week, but it was just, you know. But,
it's like practice stuff.
But content they didn't stress at all.
Yeah.
There was a broadcast news writing class that you could take, but it wasn't a prerequisite to being on the air and doing stories, reporting stories.
So what they're teaching now, you're saying, Mark, what you're telling me now is that what they're teaching in the journalism classes or in the media classes that have to do with news is not news. They're teaching entertainment value.
Right. It's all the technical part of it and the graphics and all that sort of thing.
Right.
So I've marginalized myself to photography and videography pretty much because...
Yeah.
But even, you know, like those $3 bills you said you found with that picture of...
Yeah, Screaming Hillary.
Yeah, you can even screw around the pictures, so...
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's Mike, sad. It's a sad state we've found.
It's not just a sad state, Mike. It is an assault on democracy. That's
absolutely
the bottom line. As de Tocqueville pointed out in 1835, and Mike, thanks so much for the call. As de Tocqueville pointed out in 1835, you cannot have a functioning democracy without a well-informed electorate. Actually, as Thomas Jefferson pointed out in the 1780s, you can't have a functioning democracy without a well-informed electorate. And that has always been the basis of our democracy until Reagan came along. Carol in San Diego, California. Hey, Carol.
Hi. Oh, Tom, I wanted to talk about that fairness deal. I'm in San Diego, as you heard, and, of course, I know it's all Republican and military, but, you know, they took my Air America off in November, Clear Channel, and I called everyone in the world ranting and raving, and apparently, maybe they'll come back after the election, but it's terrible, and I don't know what more to do about it. I called the Clear Channel and FCC and my representatives. And anyway, my daughter hooked me up with a computer, but
well, that's the thing.
Really
a lot of now I understand, Carol, and I appreciate your call and your commentary. All I can say is that increasingly, if you look at conservative talk radio, what you see is that when they first started out, when Limbaugh first started out doing conservative talk radio, and it was really the first time it had come back since Father Coughlin, you know, serious political talk radio, and Coughlin was taken off the air in the 40s, maybe the late 30s. And when he started out, at first it was like, this is kind of shaky. You know, the first year or two, it was very shaky. It was very questionable. By the third year, it was becoming broadly accepted. Then it became a phenomenon for a couple of years. Remember, there were rush rooms all over the country, and it was like just a hot thing. And then the ratings started to settle down, and it became just a normal, accepted format. I would submit to you that progressive talk radio is going through that same curve, that we went through the, you know, hey, is this the new thing? Is it going to work? And then we went to the, wow, this is the hot thing, and now we're settling in. And frankly, I mean, we've picked up four new stations now in the last 2 months, and two of them are stations that are literally turning on in new markets, brand new, you know, Bellingham, Washington, Missoula, Montana, where there wasn't progressive talk radio before, and because people are saying, Yeah, this is a serious format. This is legitimate. And frankly, I think it's just a matter of time before somebody in San Diego goes back and looks and says, you know, KLSD, they were pulling about a one share in that market. You can make money with that. If you've got a dead stick, you can, let's put some money, you know, let's make some money on it. And increasingly all around the country. So I'm not sure that that's so much about the issue of infotainment or not, news or not. But the whole idea of balance is one that is just, you know, Americans in general respond positively to the idea, you know, frankly, of balance. Mar in Los Angeles. Hey, Mar.
Hey, Tom. You know, I've noticed most credible reporters have left network news because they get to a point they just can't stomach it anymore. And I haven't watched network evening news in years and years and years. I get my news from Air America or the Internet, email.
But see, Air America is not a news network, and a lot of the stuff on the Internet is you know, clearly and openly biased stuff. I mean, you can't get straight news on Drudge anymore, and you get straight news on Buzzflash. It is news. There's information there, but it's news with an angle. The BBC is providing straight news. We've got, you know, NPR in the United States, which is supposed to be doing that. But now they've got all these sponsorships for it, and you know, it's been a long time since NPR outed Archer Daniels Midland ADM and cost them, I think it was $300 million or something. It's a huge fine for price fixing, and now, you know, ADM is sponsoring them. The whole system in this country has been corrupted, and frankly, I think we just need to go back to this core idea of there is the commons of the media, there is the commons of at the very least. Of television, radio, and cable systems, frankly, because cables go through our commons. They use our rights of way, our roads and things. And that commons deserves respect. Our democracy deserves respect. And part of that is that we realize that we have to have real information if we're going to have a real democracy. Brian in Everett, Washington. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Our idea of justice has been altered by the media. I think you're speaking my language, which isn't a common tongue among Americans. Pardon me. But the idea that David Schuster can use this word, and then all of a sudden he needs to be punished, you know. But the idea is that, guess what, there really is human trafficking and that stuff going on, you know. And those are and just the fact that people are set up, you know, as media scapegoats and people have to go through all these rituals of suspension, which, you know, maybe right. But, you know, everyone is just lashing out.
The problem is David Schuster was dropped into the middle of a broken system.
Well, yeah.
He never should have been asked a question in the first place about his opinion, or he never should have felt comfortable offering it.
Well, honestly,
if he's doing news,
well, that's the thing. But it's amazing how we can really gear up a lynch mob against people with the media.
Yeah,
you know, and say, well, this is the guy that's responsible. This is the guy.
Right. It's the same thing that happened with Don Imus. Although there's a huge difference. Don Imus was a commentator. Don Imus is a guy who offers commentary. David Schuster is a newsman. Yeah. He should be offering news, and that's where the firewall needs to be. Brian, thanks a lot for your comments. Jeff in Orange County, California. Hey, Jeff. Got to have taking a break here in a little less than a minute. What's up?
Okay, I just wanted to kind of really quickly say it's really funny to me that there is no coverage of the FISA, but you're going to get live, wall-to-wall, Roger Clemens steroid coverage. And in conjunction with that, lately, Arlen Specter is become to my mind for his fake outrage about the New England Patriots taping trade secrets in a very big business called the NFL. How about $9.5 billion missing in Iraq, Arlen Specter?
Yeah.
How about start doing the
a pile of money big enough that you can see it from outer space and
Absolutely.
It's gone missing. I mean, and these are actual physical dollars. This isn't like electronic transfers, you know, in the banking system or something. They shipped billions of dollars, $9 billion over there on pallets, shrink wrapped. It's gone. We don't know where. We've got some very happy buddies over there, and we got a whole lot of very PO'd Iraqis who are shooting at us because this thing has been so screwed up, and somehow John McCain thinks he can run and win on it, perhaps because our media is so dysfunctional. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That you travel on, there's one day here and the next day gone. Sometimes you bend, sometimes you stand, sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside every darkened door where blues won't haunt you anymore. Where the brave are free and lovers soar. Come ride with me to the distant shore. We won't hesitate to break down.
garden gate.
And welcome back, my friends. No, we're breaking down all the gates. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program on Air America Radio. And strange stuff going on out there. As Bruce Merkin notes over at Alternet, recent weeks have seen a rash of new studies of marijuana hitting the mass media, generating scary headlines like smoking pot rots your gums and cannabis bigger risk than cigarettes and pot withdrawals similar to quitting cigarettes. Yeah. When you, as he notes, I mean, apropos of our conversation today, he says, mercifully, the U.S. media were so distracted by Super Tuesday Heath Ledger's autopsy and the latest Britney Spears trauma that reports of these studies didn't get as much play as they might have. That's good because the research had significant gaps. Basically, this was all nonsense research. Phony research. Phony baloney research. Badly done. Poorly done. Poorly executed. Crazy. And but it was reported as news. Again, because we have this bizarre infotainment industry out there that... Anyway, Herman in Ohio. Hey, Herman, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Hey, listen, I just got to talking to Andrew Wilkow. He's the extreme right talk show host on Sirius 144. This guy is so blind. He's got blinders on, his blinders, okay? He's inciting the masses to riot.
Yeah, I got it. What's your point, Herman?
Well, I wanted to make this clear that racism in America is it's non-essential. We have one race, it's the human race, and within that race, we have different ethnic groups, okay? And if Hillary decides to do something for her campaign, to better her campaign, it's nothing against anybody. You see, she's just trying to get the job done. And that's what we should want here today. Is to get the job done.
Yeah, it's we are now rapidly becoming, and frankly, the younger generation, I'd say, already is a post-racial society. Obviously, we still have a long way to go, and I don't want to just proclaim, oh, the end of racism in America. Obviously, there's a huge problem of racism in America and sexism, misogyny in the United States. And I mean, here we have the Democratic Party has an African American and a woman running as president of the United States. It's a great day for America. Earl in Ann Arbor. Hey, Earl, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? A few callers back, you spoke of the death of democracy. Well, you put another nail in the coffin. The top of the hour, CNN reported that the Senate okays immunity for telecoms.
They just did, huh?
And it's reported on Raw Story as well. By a vote of 31-67, they rejected an amendment that would have stripped a grant of immunity.
Yeah, that was the Specter Amendment, or was that the Feingold Amendment?
I'm not certain who it was, but I just wanted to report that to you.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, onward we go. Steve in Los Angeles. Hey, Steve, what's up?
I'm good, Tom. How are you?
Just fine.
Good. You know, that was interesting to hear the results of the Senate election.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you something, just to cut to the point. Now, this is just my take. I do not claim perfection on this. I agree with almost every one of your callers. But it's like preaching to the choir. About 18 months ago, I think it was, Seymour Hersh said in New Yorker, if one is smart, one will get oneself a foreign passport and some foreign real estate and start thinking about making a move. I don't know that this is retrievable, although I will concede that this is a turning point, this election.
Yeah. But this election is the turning point, Steve, I'm telling you. And Cy Hirsch, if George Bush were to declare some sort of state of emergency, or frankly, if John McCain is elected president, I may be inclined to agree with Cy Hirsch. I mean, that's how serious I think it is at this time. I mean, you've got Max Boot talking about John McCain being bellicose and how that's a wonderful thing. We haven't seen that since, making Hitler analogies is so trite and so lame. But it's like you look at what Hitler did with Poland, demonizing Poland and saying, oh, they're going to attack us, and using that as a basis to attack them. And then, on and on it went. And it's like, in many ways, we've seen this movie before and we don't need to see it again. Quinn, or at least pieces of this movie. Quinn in Sunnydale, California. Hey, Quinn.
Hey, Tom. Right now I'm a college student. I'm studying journalism as a major. I originally was studying physical anthropology, and the reason why I switched my major was I started watching the news more, video or television news, and I was really distraught with you know, exactly what you were talking about, how it's turned into infotainment.
Right.
And I switched to journalism, and I'm studying print journalism specifically because I think that is what we need to go back to. I think there needs to be serious training of print journalism students so that they can go out and be professional journalists who are fact gatherers, who are going out and getting information without adding their opinion on this.
And investigative reporting also. Investigative reporting has been massively undercut recently. And this is where, when Murdoch bought the Wall Street Journal, I actually had a moment of mourning. I mean, you know, just a pain of loss, because the Wall Street Journal actually used to be, although their editorials were just, you know, right-wing crackpot stuff, right out of the lunatic fringe, their reporting was some of the best in the country. They broke the story of healthcare rationing in the United States, the five-part series. They broke the story of William McGuire, the CEO of the second largest health insurance company in the United States, for taking a $1.78 billion paycheck compensation package over 10 years. They broke a whole lot of stories that you know, weren't progressive or conservative or anything. They were simply, here's the state of the nation. And they're just not going to do that anymore under Murdoch, and I think it's just tragic. So I salute you, Quinn, for getting into journalism, and please work to move your industry in the right direction. But here's the problem. It is just, you're welcome, and thanks for the call. It is just like with Walmart. I mean, this is the thing. People call up and they say, oh, Walmart is terrible, you know. And my answer is, well, you know, Walmart is doing what's legal, by and large. I mean, you know, when they do things that are illegal, you nail them for it, but they're doing what's legal. If we don't like the way the game is being played, if the game is not being played in a way that enhances democracy and strengthens this country, then let's change the rules of the game back to a system that does work for democracy. This requires a legislative response. We need to reimpose a not necessarily the Fairness Doctrine, but responsibility in broadcasting.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. Dinesh D'Souza is on the line with us. Back on the program with us. He's the Rishwain Research Scholar at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, author of several best-selling books, including Illiberal Education, The Virtue of Prosperity, and What's So Great About America, former policy analyst with the Reagan White House. His website, Dinesh D'Souza, DineshDSouza.com, and his new book, now out in paperback, The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. Dinesh, welcome to the program.
Good to be on the show again.
Thank you. Glad to have you back with us. So, once again, I'm responsible for 9/11. You say liberals are responsible for 9/11?
Well, not you, because you haven't had much power. The cultural left that I'm talking about is the cultural left that has been either enshrined in the government or has been active in promoting, you might say, liberal values abroad. We often hear from the left about the backlash in the Muslim world against American foreign policy. Well, why is it so hard to believe that there's a backlash in the Muslim world against what are seen to be decadent liberal values?
For example, when the Supreme Court back in, I think it was 1887, declared that it was unconstitutional, or it was illegal, it was appropriate for there to be laws in the United States against polygamy.
Laws against polygamy? Well,
right. Yeah, you're saying that these traditional throughout your book, Dinesh, the point that you keep making is that traditional cultures want to hold on to their traditional values, and we are violating those values, and therefore they're appropriately angry with us and they hit us on 9/11. And certainly one of those values is polygamy.
Let me put it differently. I'm saying that the radical.
That's how you put it in your book.
I'm saying that the radical Muslims go to the ordinary Muslim on the Muslim street and portray America as an atheist and decadent society. Now, look, if the Muslims want to have polygamy, they should be able to
have it. But we're not an atheist and decadent society, and we need to be out there saying, you know, hey, we're here, and by the way, it has nothing to do with atheism or not atheism or decadence or not decadence. I mean, there was, frankly, what I, you know, my main argument with your book is that I believe that what we're seeing, and I wrote a chapter for From the Ashes, the Rodale book that Billy Graham and the Pope and the Dalai Lama contributed to right after October, right after 1 month after 9/11. You know, this book came out, From the Ashes, A Spiritual Response to 9/11. And the point that I made was that what we're seeing right now is not a war between Islam and Christianity. It's not a war between two great religions or even two great cultures. It's a war between the 11th century and the 20th century or the 21st
century. That's a foolish way to look at things because
it is absolutely not. Because what you're seeing right now in the Muslim world where violence is the way is the exact same thing we saw in the Christian world in the 11th century when Pope Urban declared the crusade.
Look, the thing is, Tom, let me ask you this question. What percentage of Muslims live in a polygamous marriage?
I don't have any idea, but I can tell you that the majority of Muslims around the world live in societies that condone polygamy.
Well, what I'm saying is it's a big difference whether...
It has nothing to do with whether... No, the point that you're making is their society, not their individual lives.
What I'm saying is if polygamy was widespread in the Muslim world, there would be a radical imbalance between the number of men and women. In reality, only about 1% or fewer of Muslim marriages are polygamous. Most Muslims have one wife. So you're operating according to an ethnocentric, prejudiced view of Islam in which you're assuming...
No, I have been in...
has more than one wife.
But that's their culture, and that's
what if I were to say one
Dinesh, I have been in polygamous homes in the Middle East. I've hung out with a guy who had four wives. He had his 60-year-old wife, his 40-year-old wife, his 30-year-old wife, and his 20-year-old. Louise and I spent an entire day there with these folks. I mean, very nice people. But and I mean, this is right. You know, this is in a major country in the Middle East. It's not an absolutely uncommon thing. Your argument is when we come in and say you guys should that we don't have polygamy, maybe you should consider emulating us, that therefore they're justified in attacking us on 9/11. And I say nonsense.
If one American in 100 beats his wife, does that mean we're living in the 11th century?
We haven't legalized it.
What? Look.
It is legal to have more than one wife.
It might be legal.
In Saudi Arabia, in Oman, in Jordan, in all of these countries throughout the Middle East.
The
family where Louise and I spent the time with this polygamous Arab family was in Israel.
Tom, it's silly to argue. Polygamy is a very ancient institution. I'm not for polygamy, but I'm saying if a Muslim society living under Muslim law democratically says, okay, yeah, we want to allow people to marry three wives. Look, it can't be widespread because the number of men and women in any society is roughly equal. So really, if every Muslim man had four wives, three out of four Muslims would be without a wife. So that's not a stable arrangement.
Not if you have a society that has been that. Not if you have a society that has a lot of warfare where a lot of men get killed off.
I know, but look, Islam's been around for 1,300 years. Islamic radicalism has been around in recent decades. So this is a relatively
This is my point. What
religion.
We're looking at here, Dinesh, is not that 9/11 is a consequence of the... First of all, the liberalism that you're talking about is Jeffersonian liberalism, essentially, modernity. It's not the consequence of that. What it's the consequence of is
the
infectious spread of Wahhabism. Say what?
It's the consequence of 60s liberalism, not the liberalism of Jefferson. And the Muslims aren't objecting about the right to vote or to assemble. They're objecting to what are seen as Hollywood values, abortion on demand, homosexuality promoted. You have to read their stuff to see it's a major theme for them. Now, you can deny that, but you can't deny that.
I have read their stuff, Dinesh. You know, Syed Qutb, the guy who really started the Muslim Brotherhood,
right,
was in the United States back in the 40s. It was 1949 in Colorado. He went to a church-sponsored square dance and was so offended by what he saw. And this was a 1940... I mean, most American conservatives say, yeah, let's go back to the 50s.
Tom,
right? This was a church-sponsored square dance. And he said, this is decadent.
Tom,
he went back to Egypt, and his organization then went on to assassinate the president of Egypt. He was executed for that. His number two guy, his disciple, Ayman Zawahiri, went off to Afghanistan and took under his wing Osama bin Laden and thus directly to 9/11. And if you think that we should stop having church socials and square dances in the United States so we don't get hit by Osama bin Laden again, I'd say you're nuts.
I would be nuts if I were to say that. But see, we can't have a conversation because you're being indignant over nothing.
But that's the essence of your book.
All right, well, let me talk for a moment. Look, let's talk about Qutb for a moment. His objection to the dance wasn't that people were dancing, but he thought it was odd that they were dancing in a church. I do think that in most countries in the world, if you go into a Hindu temple or a mosque, generally you don't see dances. So you can see why he thought that was strange.
Actually, go back and read his writings, Dinesh. His objection
struck America. I'm simply saying that Saeed Qutb, who was seen as an extremist in 1940 when he first wrote, is not seen as extremist today, because many traditional Muslims who have no problem with church dances see Qutb as being prophetic in describing American culture as
his
going into what
problem, he mentioned the church. His problem wasn't the fact that dancing was going on in the church. He did consider that a defilement. His problem was that people were picking their own spouses, that there was a social custom where strangers, men and women who didn't know each other, were touching each other.
Pardon me for interrupting. Do you realize that in Islam you have an absolute right in the Koran to pick your own spouse?
Yes,
what are
but
you
that's
talking
not
about?
Consistent.
Arranged marriage is very common.
There are all kinds of things in the Quran that are inconsistent with the culture that attacked
nonsense.
Us on 9/11.
That's nonsense. Arranged marriage
just
is very
like
common.
There are things in the Bible that are inconsistent with the culture that attacked us in Oklahoma City.
All
we
I
have
think.
11th century Christians just like there are 11th century Muslims. We need to be bringing all of these groups into the modern world
rather than saying, let's
respect 11th century perspectives.
Look. In India, where I grew up, arranged marriage is common. It is fairly common in Hinduism. It is quite rare in Islam. Now, you might be objecting to other things, polygamy.
I'm saying that's what Qutb was objecting to.
Saeed Qutb never defended arranged marriage.
He objected to strangers having physical contact in the square dance for the purposes of finding a mate.
He thought it was inappropriate for unmarried members of the opposite sex to be dancing in a church.
Right, and you're saying that if we don't start aligning ourselves with his values, that it's our fault
that
9/11...
I'm saying that if you want to be a cosmopolitan person, you should realize why, from the point of view of many traditional people, not just Qutb, my mom, who's 70 years old, who's Christian and lives in India, would find some of the same things a little objectionable. Now, she was not.
Is she going to blow us up over it?
She's not going to take up weapons or fly planes into buildings. But on the other hand, the moral critique of American society does resonate with traditional Muslims. Why are you so blind to that?
That's not the point. My point is that this is not a difference between Muslim society and Christian society. It is a difference between, it is a battle, frankly, between the 11th century and the 21st century. You had a small group of guys who were adhering to the 11th century, from Qutb all the way to Osama bin Laden. It was a small group. It was 20,000 people had been through bin Laden's program and were aligned with him. When Bush declared war against them and used words
Crusader or whatever.
Crusade, yeah, thank you very much. That's what fired the whole thing. And now it's a movement on their side.
Well, I don't think it's so small a movement. Look, these are guys who win elections. The Muslim Brotherhood has won elections in Egypt.
Yeah,
Hamas won elections. So it's a larger group than you're making it sound.
Dinesh, you want to stick around?
Absolutely.
Okay, stick around.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sick Bob and TV shows. I need some dirt road onto my feet. Come on, let's point out toes where the red...
So here's the question, my friends. Are you and I, the cultural left, responsible for 9/11? With us, Dinesh D'Souza, DineshDSouza.com, his website, Dinesh D'Souza, Rich Wayne Research Scholar at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, author of a number of best-selling books, New York Times bestsellers, his new book, The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11, now out in paperback. Dinesh, thanks for sticking around.
You're welcome.
So the point that I was making, and I wanted to give you a chance to rebut, you know, to respond to it. I hate just slamming people into a break like that, but we have hard breaks on this show, and you know how that works. Anyhow, the point that I was making is that what we're seeing here is a battle between the 11th century and the 21st century, and frankly, we're seeing it played out in Christianity as well as Islam. When Tim McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City federal building, he was operating out of that same 11th century mind view that violence is the way to bring about social change. And he represents a very small and very marginalized bunch of Christianity, or part of Christianity in the United States and around the world. And it became even more marginalized because the response to it by Bill Clinton was to say, this guy is nuts. This guy's a criminal. We're going to put him in jail. George Bush, on the other hand, when a guy who was equally nutty, equally a criminal, and frankly, equally marginalized, you know, represented a very, very small, less than 1% perspective in Islam, Osama bin Laden presumably attacked us on 9/11 when he did. George Bush, instead of saying, this guy is nuts, this guy's a criminal, and when Afghanistan said, we'll hand him over to you for trial, Bush said, no thank you, and started dropping bombs on them. Instead of choosing the rule of law and marginalizing him and bringing all of Islam, or a larger portion of Islam, into the embrace of the modern world, Bush instead declared a crusade and started dropping bombs on Muslims and radicalized Islam. I would say that not only was the cultural left not responsible for 9/11, but that the conservative right has turned 9/11 into just a horror show for the entire world and empowered the radicals within Islam.
Okay. Well,
your
first
turn.
Of all, let me say a couple of things. First of all, I think it is a silly way to understand other cultures to just look at your own historical past and basically say, well, listen, I didn't like the 11th century here in Europe because we had a lot of religious wars. So I'm going to just assume that there's an onward march of history in which I represent the future. The people I don't like represent the past. And so therefore, if anybody I don't agree with coming from Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam, I'll just declare that they live in the 11th century, even though they are sharing the planet with me now. So first of all, so I think that's an ethnocentric Western, foolish, limited way to
if I was speaking in absolutes and total generalities, I would absolutely agree with you, Dinesh. I absolutely would. And in fact, I'm very often on this program, I hold up values of older cultures, Native American cultures, Aboriginal indigenous people
as being, in many cases,
superior to our own values. What I'm talking about is the use of violence as a way of promoting religion.
Here in the West, we've had a history of interdenominational conflict that goes back to the Reformation, in some ways even earlier. But in Islam, they've had a very different history. Yes, they fought us in the Crusades, but you haven't had the internecine strife within Islam that we've seen in the West. Okay, here's the second point. Right after 9/11...
Wait a second. You've never heard of the Kharijites or the Assassins?
And what percentage were they of the Muslim world?
Well, they were fairly... Frankly, I don't know, but they were fairly...
Okay, it was less than one. But here's my point.
But my point is, yes, there has been battle within the Muslim world. Look at the different, the battles between Shia and Sunni that emerged, within what, 38 years after the death of Muhammad?
That was a succession battle. That was a succession battle over...
It has been bloody for 800 years.
Is that so surprising? Look, the Roman Empire, the British Empire, they have been...
No, but my point is that it is still bloody between the Shia and the Sunni. Look at the war between Saddam Hussein, the Sunni, and the Shia Iranians. I mean, it's still going on 900 years later. In Christianity, well, you could argue that it was still bloody in Ireland, I suppose, between Protestants and Catholics.
I hate to keep correcting you. The war between Saddam and Iran had nothing to do with Shia and Sunni. A majority of Iraqis are Shia. They were, the very fact that they were perfectly willing to fight against Khomeini and kill Khomeini's fellow Shia shows you it was not a religious
war. But within Iran, it was being positioned as a religious
war.
Yeah,
that was not successful because if the Shia in Iraq saw it that way, Iraq could never have fought that war because a majority of
Iraqis had no choice. They lived under a dictator. The Iranians were volunteering to fight that war because they saw it as the Sunni country, the Sunni Saddam Hussein invading them.
All right.
I mean, you know the history of this.
Of course I do, but you're portraying ultimately a power struggle, which Khomeini...
What I'm saying is that in the Muslim world, even today, you have two factions who are willing to kill each other. And by and large, in the Christian world, and in Judaism, and in Buddhism, and in Hinduism, that was left behind hundreds of years ago.
Well,
I realize there are
Buddhism
exceptions like Ireland, but I don't think that they're the exceptions that make the rule.
In Buddhism and Hinduism, the factions never existed in the same way. Now, here's the point about bin Laden. After 9/11, there were a lot of polls that showed that far from this guy being a bandit of the McVeigh variety, that there were substantial minorities and in some cases majorities who agreed with him, thought this was overdue, proclaimed him to be a kind of a rock star.
Not until after we began bombing Afghanistan. If you look at, look at the days after 9/11, in downtown Tehran, they were having demonstrations in favor of the United States, in support of us.
But the bombing of Afghanistan was a belated and very considered response to 9/11. Do you think that was not a good idea?
I think it was a terrible idea. I think we should have taken bin Laden when they offered him to us and put him on trial, and that would have been the end of it.
Well, I don't think the Taliban offered him to us in good conscience. I mean,
well, they made the offer and we turned it down.
A naive view of world affairs, I'm afraid.
Okay. DineshDeSouza.com has booked The Enemy at Home, The Cultural Left and Its Responsibility for 9/11. Dinesh, it's always great battling with you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, I want to offer a jolly good fellow, an absolute take good on you, to the 31 senators, all of them Democrats, with the single exception of Bernie Sanders, who caucuses with the Democrats. He's an independent. Not a single Republican. The 31 Democratic senators who unsuccessfully voted to strip immunity for the phone companies out of this new so-called Protect America Act. It should be called the Bush and Buddies Immunity Act. This is disgraceful. 67 nays, including a number of Democrats. Feinstein voted no. Inouye voted no. Carper voted no. Bayh voted no. Salazar, Nelson and Nelson, Pryor. Who are some of the other Democrats here? Johnson, Cole. Why? Lieberman, Lincoln. I don't get it. McCaskill, Mikulski, and Debbie Stabenow, and Jim Webb. Even we're going to have to there's got to be a story behind the story here. Well, it'll come out. So should I have challenged Dinesh D'Souza, since he so seems to love the 11th century values, to a duel? What do you think? 1-866-303-2270, our phone number. Kathy in Los Angeles. Hey, Kathy, you're on the air.
I'm not going to defend Dinesh D'Souza, ever. And he doesn't make a very convincing cut-rate Edward Said, in my opinion. But isn't there a place that for America to actually think through what the reasons might be that we were attacked and what our part in that might be?
Yes.
I kind of like you to address that we went so quickly to support our troops and all these kinds of things and never did the work saying, what have we done to upset people so badly? They were willing to kill themselves to kill us.
Right. I absolutely agree, Kathy, and it's a national dialogue that we have not been allowed to have, because it's like, oh, my God, you're taking the side of the terrorists?
Yeah.
To say, and it's the same thing with many conflicts around the world. You can't have that conversation because then you're on the side of the bad guys. No, it's important for us to understand the side of the bad guys. Osama bin Laden in 1998, when he essentially declared war on us, said out loud in public, printed in the New York Times, that he was coming after us because we were defiling his home country of Saudi Arabia, his motherland, the holiest spot of Islam, by having, and Kathy, the noise from your phone in the background is really loud. I'm sorry, I'm going to drop the call, but thank you very much for calling. He said, because we were keeping U.S. soldiers at the, I think it's called the Prince Sultan bin Sultan or whatever it is, Air Force Base in Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, was a temporary positioning back in 91 under Bush Sr. so that we could stage troops for the invasion of Kuwait. And they were supposed to then leave. And we put those troops there and they were still there. And Osama bin Laden was, hey, you've got women running around without headscarves, driving cars, and you got men drinking liquor and looking at pornography, and this is unacceptable in the Holy Land, number one. And number two, he said, you've got Arab regimes that are selling oil, our sacred resource, at cut-rate prices in a corrupt, unholy alliance with oil companies and governments in the United States, and this is wrong, and change these things. Basically, he wanted us to pull our troops out of Saudi Arabia and to raise the price of oil to about $100 a barrel. Well, guess what? Our troops were pulled out of Saudi Arabia by George W. Bush last year, and the price of oil is approaching $100 a barrel. Looks to me like Osama bin Laden, who is still free and living the good life, got everything he wanted, and you and I, and frankly, much of the rest of the world got screwed on this deal. Ryan in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Ryan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I'm fine. What's up?
So I wanted to say a couple things. First of all, I thought it was very inappropriate for Dinesh to draw a hard and fast causal relationship between American liberalism and 9/11, when clearly the precedence and the very strong and long historical precedence was a strict adherence to religion. And I know you don't like evangelical atheists, but I like the way Christopher Hitchens has sort of constructed this idea that without that strict adherence to religion, much of this may well have been able to, we may well have been able to avoid a lot of this.
You know, broadly, I wouldn't disagree with that. And I have no problem, by the way, with evangelical atheism, as long as they are willing to own to that label. That's my problem.
Yeah.
But let me just suggest to you that if there was not a religious position for them to use as their excuse, it would have been a nationalist position.
Right. And so, one other thing I wanted to say is I saw that Dinesh does sort of vilify people like even Noam Chomsky, who have come out against America being sort of ethnocentric and implying its standards and really acting as a outlaw state. But he vilifies these people for speaking up, as he calls it, liberally. But they align on much of these things. And I think, as Kathy was raising, what could be some potential causes of 9/11? And I certainly do think that ethnocentrism by Americans is entirely plausible, as one of the precipitating factors.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I would also add that we need to consider the hard work that Jimmy Carter did trying to bring together Israel and the Palestinians, and
no
for
doubt.
Which he appropriately won a Nobel Prize, and how that just got totally dumped. And frankly, I think that the festering problem between Israel and the Palestinians is one that, I mean, we've put so much money into that region of the world and so much effort that frankly needs to be resolved as well. Is it Harry in Livermore?
Yes.
Or Harry?
Yes. Long-time, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I wanted to, in the context of this discussion, I wanted to draw attention to the U.S. vetoes against Israel.
Mm-hmm.
In the last probably 13 or probably 20 years, if you look at it, there are many resolutions against Israel in the United States.
In the United Nations, you mean?
Some of them are...
Yeah, there have been many resolutions against the United States as well, and there have been many resolutions against the, against Arafat and on and on it goes. The fact of the matter is, Israel is our ally. Israel has been a good friend for a long, long time. Israel, to a large extent, shares our values. And we need to be bringing other countries in the region into that same sphere of being our allies and our friends and sharing our values, frankly, in my opinion.
Yeah, here, some of the cases, it is a condemnation against Israel's action. It is vetoed 8-1.
Yeah.
So that one, it's kind of like it starts a different sentiment outside the United States in the third world. Frankly speaking, many of these vetoes make it feel like, the whole UN is kind of like a puppet of U.S.
But see, that's, I get your point. But the fact of the matter is that the Security Council does work by consensus, that one country can veto it. And, this happens all the time, including in resolutions condemning the United States, in resolutions condemning the Soviet Union, in resolutions condemning China. I mean, pick your country. There are going to be resolutions where a single country says, no, we're not going to go along with that. And that's life. Maria in Bergen County, New Jersey. Hey, Maria.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good. I was calling because I thought it was interesting that your guest had mentioned that abortions on demand were part of the reason we were attacked on 9/11, and yet his mother was living in India, which hasn't been attacked by Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, but yet they practice female selective abortion, and they also abandon their baby girls because girls really have no value in Indian society.
In some parts of Indian society.
Pardon?
In some parts of Indian society.
Yeah,
India is a huge and diverse nation. Yeah.
So
no, and in his book, I mean, that's one of the points that he makes, is that there are these traditional societies, and then there's modern society, and then there's modern society, in his opinion, on steroids, the values of the 60s, and I guess he thinks that they're looking at old movies of the hippies or something and going, oh, my God, this is it. We've got to attack 9/11. And actually, he's not, Dinesh isn't here to defend himself. I'm not going to try and characterize him. But yeah, your point is well taken, Maria. Thank you very much. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, WTKG. Hey, Rick.
Yes, it's a good debate there between you and Mr. D'Souza, but
he's always good for that.
Yeah,
My
first point would be that we know that conservatives will condemn the liberals who don't support the war, for instance, and call them the "blame America first" crowd. You've heard that,
right?
Well, now here, of course, liberals are Americans. I mean, maybe some people don't think they are, and he seems to be blaming liberal values, for what's going on in the antipathy between the Arab and or Muslim and Western culture. But of course, even with respect to American troops being over there, I mean, I don't like it because I don't want American lives being sacrificed for these despotic regimes. I guess he feels they're defiling their land, but does he realize that those troops were initially sent over there, like you said, under Bush Sr., to protect Saudi Arabia? Or
Yes, he does. He does, and acknowledges that. But that's, you know, that's not central to his argument. But your point is well taken, Rick. Thank you very much, Joan in Montana. We've got about a minute before the break here, Joan. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say I was talking about the elections, mm-hmm. and I think that the Republicans do not have a format, so they don't talk about their own president, who is Bush. They talk about Reagan, and they don't talk about the things that the Republican members of Congress and the Senate accomplished, because they did nothing for the American people.
That's right, and they don't even talk about what Reagan did, because Reagan didn't do anything that, by and large, they would agree with now. I mean,
they figure that people can't go back and look and see what Reagan did,
but
they can go back and see what Bush did, so they bring up Reagan to kind of diversionary tactic, and that's why they're bailing out of the Congress and the Senate this year, because
absolutely
they have
right,
nothing,
Joan.
They have nothing to brag about.
That's right. You're absolutely right. Very, very, very well said, Joan. And they don't talk about the fact that it was Reagan who gave amnesty to aliens. It was Reagan who ran up the biggest budget deficits. It was Reagan who broke the bank here in the United States. And we're still paying for it. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
Something country. Now play something country.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, is on the line with us. Ellen, I've got to bring my own tent to the Sudan.
We're going to have a discussion, but I'm going to order tents for everybody.
Okay. Thank you.
Apparently, you can get a 4-pound lightweight tent.
Yeah, well, let's have them pre-delivered. It's because in any case, that's another discussion for another time.
That's another discussion.
Yeah.
Okay, today is the Chesapeake or Potomac primary, depending on how you
view it. But before we get to that, may I ask you a question about the FISA vote that just happened?
Oh, yeah, I was going to get to that second, but we'll get to that first.
Great. I don't get why some of these Democrats, particularly like Jim Webb, for example, Debbie Stabenow, I mean, Carl Levin voted. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Carl Levin voted yes on this. Not Carl Levin, but, both Nelsons prior, by, he's kind of DLC. Carl, you know, why did so many Democrats vote to block the amendment that would have stripped immunity for the telcos out of this bill?
I have no idea. It was a 67-31 vote.
Yeah.
Worse than that, you said Stabenow, because I didn't remember seeing her on the bad guy list.
Hang on just a second. Let me see here. She's not on the yays, and she is on the nays. Yes, she voted no with the 67.
I just spoke to her about that. I said, I hope you're voting the right way. She said, oh, yeah, and we talked about it.
Landrieu, Johnson, Cole, these are the Democrats. Lincoln, who voted no. McCaskill, Mikulski. I mean, I'm baffled. Conrad?
I'm baffled as well. And then there was another, that was Dodd-Feingold. Then Feinstein came up with a surveillance oversight amendment that there would be oversight as to who they were tapping and all that. And that went down.
Right.
63-35.
Do you think, like, some of them were voting no on Amendment A because they thought that Amendment B was better, but then Amendment B lost? There might have been that kind of thing?
That's the impression I got when I talked to some of these characters a week ago. And I'm really quite shocked.
Yeah, well, I hope, I mean, here's a great opportunity for voters to hold their senators accountable, and people can go to
Congress.
The
only thing I can think of in somebody like Stabenow, who's very popular in Michigan, but, you know.
And generally a very good senator.
And generally an excellent senator, is that there were, and the Republicans immediately put out something about all these people, saying that these people, that the ones that voted, you know, to keep the amendment, were essentially voting to allow terror in this country.
Yeah, in other words, the 31 Democrats or the 30 Democrats and Bernie Sanders who stood up and said yes to strip the immunity out of the FISA bill or out of this new so-called Protect America Act. I call it the Bush and Buddies Amnesty Act. Those 31 senators were taking a courageous stand, and the rest of them perhaps were worried that this vote would be used against them by Republicans in future elections?
Exactly. Now, remember, it is not in the House bill. So what happens when it comes to conference?
Right. Heaven only knows.
Well, I shudder to think what happens when it comes to conference.
Yeah.
Because very often people just cave.
Yeah, very often it gets worse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so you wanted to start with the...
And there was another amendment, too, that also went down. But the surveillance oversight one, I just couldn't understand. Why would they get 63 people voting against getting some oversight on
this? Yeah. Well, this entire piece of legislation, in my opinion, is hugely flawed because, as a whole, this piece of legislation moves oversight for spying from the judiciary, which is where the Constitution placed it, specifically, particularly with the Fourth Amendment, from the judiciary, in other words, you got to go to a judge, into the executive branch. And oversight of the executive branch's spying should not be provided by the executive branch. And that's what this law does, and it does it for a six-year period, not a six-month period. I think this is just a fundamentally flawed piece of legislation, and it should be shot down in toto.
Well, I don't disagree with you, and it is beyond me why some of these people voted this way.
Yeah. Well, maybe
they
think that they can kill
the entire bill. I ran into Blanche Lincoln, and I said, you know, Senator, my brother Michael thinks part of the reason that the Bushies never went through the FISA court is because they were spying on attorneys.
Yeah, and I think that they didn't because they were spying on Democrats. And Lincoln, by the way, voted no. You know, voted on the side of the Republicans.
Exactly. I'm just shocked.
Yeah. So anyhow, you started out talking about the primaries. Give me your thoughts on that.
Okay. Well, the primaries, basically today, obviously it looks like McCain is going to take them at a very fast clip. And, of course, that's winner take all. And then it also looks like Obama takes them. Now, it's so interesting that today in Virginia and D.C. in that area, Hillary Clinton went to a political science class and did a small little thing where she was going to get some television coverage. Bill Clinton was the guy that got out on radio, and it's shocking to me that Hillary just didn't get on and do the radio. I don't understand that, because the other day she did like 25, 30 television stations on Super Tuesday, and I don't understand why they didn't put her more out there.
I think my guess would be that the perception in political campaigns, and it's probably an accurate one, is that on television you're more likely to get fluff questions and you're not going to get aggressive questioning and follow-up, and on radio you're more likely to get bushwhacked, you're more likely to get asked the tough questions and people won't let you out of it.
Well, maybe, but...
Because talk radio hosts do that for a living, and most TV people are pretending to be news people, you know?
Exactly. And the other issue is that, again, Bill Clinton has not been the best help to her. I mean, because it looks like it's a Clinton presidency, not a Hillary presidency.
Yeah, thus people calling it Billary. Although, you know... Well, yeah, I guess it's unavoidable. I don't think this is the it's a woman running thing. This is the spouse of a former president running thing, which we've never had before in the United States. So it's tough to know, you know, where are the appropriate boundaries for praising or condemning that on either side.
It's going to be interesting tonight. And, of course, Wisconsin already has Obama up.
Interesting. Very interesting. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. You can read all about it over at talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen, for dropping by today.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. And the Tom Hartman Radio program here with you. And stick around. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman program. Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program, 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Congressman Charlie Rangel is on the line with us. He's the chairman of the Committee on Ways and Means, the chairman of the board of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and the dean of the New York State Congressional Delegation. His website, house.gov/Rangel. And Congressman Rangel, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you. Great show.
Thank you. Great to have you back with us. The House and Senate are struggling with the stimulus package here. Tell us about this.
Well, we're not struggling. I don't know how much to tell you, except the president came to us finally and said that the economy needed a shot in the arm. He sent his number one salesperson, Hank Paulson, who worked with the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, and the Republican Minority Leader, John Boehner, and said they needed something, and they needed it fast. We, on the Democratic side, have been meeting with economists, but have been fearful of even mentioning the word recession for fear that we might be coasting one along. In any event, it reached a point that the economists agreed that we had to get about $150 billion into the economy as fast as possible. It had to be timely for fear that it would not have any economic impact. It had to be targeted, that is, people that would be forced to spend it because they needed to spend it to put food on the table and clothes on their back and pay the rent. And it had to be temporary because to be longer than a year, actually, it would be getting into the ever-increasing deficit. And so in the House side, the committees worked together with the Speaker, and I worked closely with the Republicans on the Ways and Means Committee, and we were able to put together a package, which was approximately $100 billion for reasons to accommodate the Republicans. $50 billion were incentives for businesses, which certainly is not targeted and is not timely, but it darn sure would be temporary. We sent the bill over to the Senate, and rather than accept it as is, they had some parliamentary problems, but ultimately they accepted the House bill and merely added to it disabled veterans and their widows, as well as low-income Social Security recipients.
Right.
We sent it to the president. Now, with all of the speed at which he wanted this to proceed, we did this last week, and we're yet to know what time this week he intends to sign the bill.
Right. Congressman Rangel, I'm curious if there has been any discussion about the timing of this and how the Republicans have pushed for this to be temporary. There are some concerns that we're already in recession. A lot of this in the Financial Times, for example, you know, the British economic press about recession in the United States, and that there's a lot of, you know, putting fingers in the dike to try to hold back the recession at least until November, which will benefit the Republicans in the election, and then pull the fingers out and let the floor drop out if a Democrat gets elected come January.
That's a little too sophisticated for me.
You don't think that there's some thinking like that going on the Republican side?
If I thought the Republicans were that sophisticated, I'd be more afraid of what's going to happen in November. But they are in such complete disarray.
Really?
It's really sad. It's embarrassing for the nation to have a president that in a stimulus package had the audacity to include, albeit not for very long, the extension of his $2 trillion tax cut package, to me just didn't make any sense at all.
Well, he's going to do that for everything. I mean, he's
just, well, that's
time for lunch here. Extend my tax cuts.
I mean, he's coming in with a $500 billion deficit. I don't know what good this is going to do. It may show that we are aware of the problem, but, you know, all of this is borrowed money.
You're right, and you know, frankly, as Mike Huckabee said, I mean, you know, we're borrowing money from China that will either be in large part transferred to the banks, people paying off their credit cards and their mortgages, or to China to buy Chinese goods. I mean, it seems that there are some real structural issues here in the United States. I mean, literally infrastructure and things like that that could stimulate the economy just as well. Certainly, Franklin Roosevelt demonstrated it works, and Dwight Eisenhower. That haven't been addressed in this. Do you think that Congress is going to have a chance to really get their teeth into this, or is it going to take another election, a larger majority, and a Democratic president to really tackle the structural issues that might be more effective at bringing this economy back on its feet?
There is no way for anything to be accomplished this year. For all practical purposes, the Republicans control the Senate. They have used the filibuster to prevent anything from coming up on the floor. They have demanded 60 votes by the Democrats in order to get anything reviewed. And they don't legislate anymore. They just reach some types of bipartisan agreements over there.
Then why haven't the Democrats done what the Republicans did, you know, during the hearings on, as I recall, it was Alito, and threatened the nuclear option? I mean, why or forced a filibuster, an actual stand on the floor and speak filibuster?
Tom, I'm afraid that you're trying to get me into political trouble
because I really think
those guys over there like each other. I mean,
they
have a camaraderie over there, and I try so often to, you know, I haven't been a chairman that long, but it's really frustrating when you haven't even had a conference where constitutionally every tax bill is supposed to originate in the House of Representatives.
Yep.
And then this goes over there. They don't pay legislation any attention at all. They get together and decide what they are prepared to do and what they're not going to do. And you ask the question, well, why don't they get on the floor and at least show where their heart is? I told one of them that, you know, just maybe if my chairmanship depended on the death or defeat of one Democrat, I might be kinder to the Republicans. But over there, it's a love-end.
Well, the Republicans certainly took names and kicked butt back when they were in the minority, you know, after Jim Jeffords changed, and they were using the filibuster and threatening Democrats who were using the filibuster. I mean, it seems like it wasn't quite that collegial when John McCain and others had to put together their gang of 14 to stop the thing from melting down.
But, you know, worse than this thing which shall come to pass at the end of this year, the real question is, what happens with our infrastructure while we're going through all of these adjustments? You know, the very same Chinese that we're buying their wares from, they take our dollar, which is not worth very much, and now they buy into our financial institutions.
Yeah.
And so it looks like for the United States, we don't invest in our educational system. And God knows that's a priority with the Chinese. And when you take a look at their numbers and our failure to provide health care for 50 million people, it's just like as though we don't want to win.
So how did, you know, Democrats look at this and say, okay, we elected a majority in the Senate, and the Senate is not doing our business, and they're rolling over every time the Republicans say, you know, woof, you know, bark at them. I mean, they're... At a certain point, I mean, I'm hearing from a lot of Democrats who are going, you know, we're not happy with this.
Well, it's a twofold show. One, it's so frustrating in the House of Representatives when you have new members and members in close districts taking courageous votes, closing loopholes, trying to reform the tax system, trying to bring an energy bill out, trying to end the war. And then when it gets over the other side, there's not even a contest.
Because they don't
fight to get closure. And the truth of the matter is that we're taking all these political risks because to be responsible, whether Republican or Democrat, you're going to lose some friends. It's painful to do the right thing many times. And so we don't even have a contest over there.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
even when they do legislate, they end up just agreeing to a package as they did with the stimulus package.
Well, we've got to get more than 60 votes over there.
Well, we hope to do a lot better this time in the Senate side. And we also hope more than anything else that there's a change in tone, that people just don't accept the war as something that we're just destined to stay in for 100 years. And that we can bring more equity to the middle class so that we don't have to pass out checks, but we can make certain that those people who work hard every day have enough in order to take care of their families.
That's well said. Congressman Charles Rangel, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, Tom, good to
see you. Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. In about a half hour from now, we're going to have Carolyn Fredrickson. She's the director of the ACLU Washington, D.C. Legislative Office on the line to get the whole inside scoop on what's going on with this FISA debate and the FISA vote and the so-called Protect America Act, the Free Pass for the Bush and Friends Act. And so we'll be getting to that. A lot on the table today. Justice Scalia in the UK on being interviewed by the BBC says, torture, it's just a fine thing.
Talking about the issue of torture, we know that cruel and unusual punishment is prohibited under the Eighth Amendment. Does that mean that the issue is a kind of, if it comes up before the court, it's a no-brainer?
Well, a lot of people think it is, but I find that extraordinary. To begin with, the Constitution refers to cruel and unusual punishment. It is referring to punishment indefinitely.
In other words, the Constitution says you can't torture somebody as punishment, but that doesn't mean that you can't torture them as an interrogation technique. I mean, how weird is this getting? Mayor Bloomberg has come out and said global warming is as big a threat as terrorism. I think he's right. In fact, frankly, it may be a bigger threat than terrorism. And life goes on. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Charles in Carmel Valley, California. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I was thinking about the what's wrong with the Democrats.
Yeah.
And they never seem to have any persistence in their arguments. They're just consistently caving in on every issue. And I mean, it doesn't show any commitment on their part.
That's the broad perception. And as far as it goes with the Senate, I agree with you that there have been so many opportunities for Democrats in the Senate to do the kind of political theater, frankly, is what it is, that the Republicans did during the nominations of Alito and Roberts. And they haven't.
Where's the loyal opposition? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's no sense of it.
And you know, who wants a leader that's weak? You know, I mean, they act like cowards.
Well, it's not even a matter of leadership and weakness. I get your point, and I think a lot of Americans would agree with it. It's a matter of respecting the will of the people. I mean, in the United States, we don't elect leaders. We elect representatives, and our representatives should be respecting our point of view. And the vast majority of us hold these particular positions that are being trampled on by the Bushies and by the Republicans. And the Democrats should be standing up for it. And I just, all I can say is, you know, take it up with Harry Reid, because he's the one who's ultimately making those decisions, tragically. Jake in Eureka, California. Hey, Jake.
Hey, Tom. Hey, if Barack Obama wins the Potomac primaries today and then next week if he wins in Hawaii and Wisconsin, Hillary Clinton's last chance of nomination will be in Texas and Ohio next month. And
That's
if she
right.
can't pull out victories there, there's going to be a lot of pressure on her to drop out of this race.
I absolutely agree with you, and it's going to be very interesting to watch. Ohio and Texas in particular, as you said, those are going to be the ones. Right now the polling looks like Barack Obama is going to sweep the Potomac primaries and pull out Wisconsin. And Ohio and Texas, it's going to be a very interesting time, very interesting time. Tim in Vista, California. Hey, Tim.
Tom. I'm so glad to talk to you. I miss you guys down here in San Diego without our progressive radio. My point was with the writer earlier who can't take any criticisms, obviously.
You mean Dinesh D'Souza?
Corporate America is to blame for 9/11 and for many other things that have happened the last 100 years in that region, from greed and the power-hungry wealthy wanting to get cheap gold, basically, off the blood of very starving poor people that want, a living cultures that just wanted to be left alone, and the greed just took over. And I think that was the response, was partly, cultural differences are always there, but those can be diplomatically reasoned out.
I think good point, Tim. And I'm not quite sure that I would draw it in such stark terms, but I would say that, the old cliche, if the main crop that was, if the main output of the Middle East was asparagus, we would not be having perpetual wars there. So, David in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, David.
Hello.
Hey,
yes, Tom, I witnessed a phenomenon here last week. I went to Obama caucus, and I have never seen anything like it in my life. I worked for McGovern in 72, but this was beyond description. The people came out with babies in their arms, standing in the cold, waiting to get in to sign up. And the event that happened in Key Arena the day before, 17,000 got in. 3,000 people stood outside in the cold just to listen to him.
Yeah, this guy's a political rock star. I mean, there's something there that is, I can't describe, it's just like,
I think,
whoa,
One word to describe him, he is messianic, and there's no question about it. This country.
Well, that's scary. That's not a good thing, in my opinion.
Well,
I'll
tell you, he is the one person who can make a change.
In that context, I think we have to be careful of the word messianic. And David, thank you for your call. But maybe Lincoln-esque or Kennedy-esque or something like that. I mean, there's a certain charismatic magic that every now and then, it seems like once a generation, some politician comes along with, and certainly he apparently has it. Thirty-four minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends. Well, we've had a variety of conversations today, from what's going on with the economy to what's going on with politics, with FISA, to our bizarre media culture and these, silly discussions over whether or not David Schuster should be fired, when really the issue we should be asking is, what's happened to our news media? What's happened to our media? All the way up to our debate with Dinesh D'Souza about the 11th century having, our actions in Afghanistan and Iraq really pumping up the 11th century faction of the Islamic world. And let us not forget that there is an 11th century faction to the Christian world as well.
You got
to
kill the terrorists before the killing stops. And I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
Yes, thank you, Jerry. Mary in Carson City, California. Hey, Mary.
Oh, hi, Tom. It's wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you. What's up?
I have a question, and I admire your opinion. Mm-hmm. And here's what I think. I love our two candidates for election this year, both Hillary and Barack Obama. And I think it's got our country very ignited. However, I'm very concerned, especially for Barack Obama's safety, because from history, whenever a sudden leader appears out of nowhere, which Barack did, and especially an African-American leader, it is often met with racism, cynicism, hatred, by a large majority of this country. And, examples of this in America.
Well, I'd say it's a small minority, but I agree with your point. And why is it always the liberals who get assassinated? Is that where you're going with this, JFK, RFK?
It really concerns me because, from history, and we always look to history for this, an American leader like Barack Obama, who is, as you say, this political rock star, he is, especially with young people. And, from the past, people like wonderful leaders like Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, President Bhutto in Pakistan, and, a large majority of this country are living in the 11th century, let alone the 1960s.
Yeah, no, I get your point, and and thank you, Mary, for the call. I don't have a good answer for it. I mean, it's one of those things where, I think we're all worried. whether it's Barack Obama or whether it's Hillary Clinton, frankly. I mean, there's a hate Hillary crowd out there as well on the right. And there's loonies with guns. And this is just, you know, we just have to hope for the best and pray for the best and work for the best in the United States. And frankly, even, you know, even if our president is John McCain, I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan, there was an assassination attempt against him, albeit, you know, it had more to do with trying to win the love of Jodie Foster than take down a movement. Nonetheless, I mean, you know, it's I guess all we can do is do our best. And regardless of who your candidate is, vote for the person that you think should be president. Everything else needs to be secondary. Pete in the Bronx, New York. Hey, Pete, what's up?
Hey, actually, it didn't have that much to do with Jodie Foster. Hinckley's father was a owner of an oil company and partners with Bush Sr. But
I know. He was having breakfast with Bush Sr., wasn't he, the day that John Hinckley...
Yes, and the rumor was that Reagan was trying to make the oil companies give back a lot of their profits, which would have put Hinckley Oil in desperate straits.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, this was the same George Bush who was also having breakfast with Osama bin Laden's brother on 9/11.
A familiar pattern begins to emerge.
Isn't that odd? I mean, you know, I'm willing to believe that these actually may be coincidences, but boy, are they bizarre.
Sure, it's all coincidence. Sure.
Okay.
Of course it is. Anyway.
But that's not what you called about.
I called Conyers' office, John Conyers' office today, because I was reading that it's impossible to get through. So I said, let me give this a shot, in reference to impeachment, of course. And I got through on the first try, spoke to his first assistant for about 20 minutes, who was incredibly informative, very open and very transparent, and basically said they're not pursuing impeachment because Conyers feels that it would tie up his entire office and it would prevent actually the investigation of the crimes that he believes that this administration has committed, and he wants to go after him much like the illegal firings of the lawyers. He feels that that's a more effective way to expose how this administration has quote unquote destroyed America.
Interesting. And end up with some real serious criminal prosecutions now or after the term.
Yeah, he was very very frustrated about it. I said, oh, by the way, what about Harriet Myers? Is she ever going to be, you know, called on the carpet for, you know, ignoring a subpoena? He said, we actually were scheduled to talk about that, but with the death of Lantos, that's been pushed back for a week.
Yeah, interesting. Pete, thanks a lot for the update. I appreciate it. Jamil in San Diego, California. Hey, Jamil.
Hello. I just wanted to point out a couple of misfacts that Dinesh had spoke about when he was concerning Islam. A couple of things. There's as much difference between Sunni and Shia as there is a difference between Catholics and Protestants. Although their basic theology is the same, Sunni and Shia, their practices and their culture is quite drastically different. And there has been long-standing battles, major battles. And right after 60 years after the Prophet's death, and that's actually the Shias still commemorate that day as one of their worst atrocities committed against them by the Sunnis.
Yeah, so, in fact, isn't that the day that they go out and flog themselves?
Yes, that is the same day.
If I'm remembering my holidays right.
Yep, that is the same day. They actually, it's a major holiday, but. For hundreds of years, there have also been long, long periods of major peace. If you look at the many empires, Muslim empires, the Ottoman, the last recent ones, they were like literally working side by side, living side by side, where the only difference was practice difference. And they were, the holiday where they flogged themselves, the Sunnis, they saw it as a holiday and they just saw it as we would commemorate 4th of July, as something to look at.
Well, you know, under Saddam Hussein, the Sunni and the Shia were not only living together and doing well, but there were huge neighborhoods, and this is one of the big problems that they've been having the last 4 or 5 years, huge sectors of Baghdad that were totally mixed, where you had Sunni who had married Shia, you had mixed families, and now you've got radicals on both sides trying to tear them apart and committing all these executions. So, yeah, your point is well taken, Jamil. And as I pointed out, we've also seen the same thing in Christianity, whether it was the Protestantism, you know, out of Old Henry, or whether it was the Protestantism out of the Lutheran Reformation. There was no shortage during earlier days in Christianity of battles going on. And we need to bring everybody into this century and say, hey, you know, there is a better way. Chris in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom, I'm going to be a little simplistic, and I apologize for it. Is it speaking out of school for those of us who simply prefer Barack Obama because of Hillary Clinton's baggage? I mean, I've seen the bumper sticker. I'm voting for Monica Lewinsky's boyfriend's wife, and I simply don't want to deal with that for the next 7 months.
Yeah.
Is it wrong to bring that up or to point it out?
I don't think so, and I think that that is, in many voters' minds, an issue. I think, frankly, it would be wrong for the Obama campaign to use it as a campaign issue.
Well,
But the reality is that there are people like you, Chris, who are saying that this, for them, is an issue. It's frankly not an issue for me. I think that Hillary, frankly, would probably be a better president than Bill, but I'm strongly in favor of either her or Obama. But I get it. You know, she's got some baggage in her husband, or rather, her husband has some baggage, and you know, it could work for her, or it could work against her, and or it might not be an issue at all. But you know, Chris, I wouldn't deny you your right to choose a candidate based on pretty much anything. Fred in Los Angeles. Hey, Fred.
Hey, Tom, I noticed that D'Souza is, like, trying to distract from the policies that were directly responsible for 9/11. It's like when the second tower got knocked down, first words out of my mouth that morning were, you do not disenfranchise a people in their own land without it biting you.
Yeah.
And that's the law of revolutions. It happened with the American Revolution and every revolution since. And it was the conservative policies laid out in the Reagan administration as the Kirkpatrick Doctrine that caused 9/11.
Yeah, and we have never had the discussion, frankly, that we need to have in the United States about it, and it's only touched upon in the 9/11 Commission report. Good point, Fred. Thank you for the call. Carson in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Carson.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Really, really good to talk to you. Love your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, Tom, the reason I'm calling, I'm really angry, I'm upset, I'm even embarrassed. The Senate has caved in and approved immunity for the telecoms for President Bush.
Yep. Well, I don't believe that the final piece of legislation has been voted on, but that amendment to it that would have stripped the immunity out of it has been defeated. So if the final piece of legislation, the so-called Protect America Act, I call it the Protect Bush and His Cronies Act, is passed, then yes, in fact, the Senate will have done that. And that, in my opinion, is tantamount to a crime. Certainly, politically.
Oh, I agree.
Politically. It's a crime against the Constitution.
You know, and if Senator Reid isn't through embarrassing the Democrats, maybe he could offer up some immunity for the plane outers while he's at it. This has really got me ticked off.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm right there with you, Carson. I'm right there with you. Thank you for the call. Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey. Hey, Richard. Richard, you're on the air.
Yeah, okay. I'm calling up for two reasons. One is you heard that the General Motors lost as much money that Exxon made in their net profits last year. Also, too, don't forget, unfortunately, the Democrats don't have the unity that the Republicans do. So, you know, when one Republican, they all vote as a block. 40% of Democrats are not liberal Democrats.
No, and that's the thing we need to keep in mind. And frankly, it makes a lot more sense in the House of Representatives. Because in the House of Representatives, you've got a bunch of Congress members of the House of Representatives, congressmen and congresswomen, Democrats, who are representing largely Republican districts. And you can understand why some of the blue dog Democrats and some of the more conservative Democrats might not always go along with their party, because they want to get reelected every 2 years. But in the Senate, why not at least stand up and filibuster? Come on, guys. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Let's be the good guys again. We're going down the wrong road, my friend. Let's return our nation to its true destination. Let's be the good guys again.
You know, I can't hear that song without remembering the Fire Sign version of it. Back in the shadows.
The common good, my friend.
Well. 9.5 minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman Program here. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our affiliated radio stations and their sponsors. Including SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy in this country should be a right, not a privilege. 1-866-303-2270, George in Queens, New York. Hey, George, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just had a point to make on what Dinesh D'Souza said. It's kind of simplistic, but I think if you follow his logic, if he's saying that because of our liberal values we were attacked,
yes,
then isn't to become more conservative to give in to the terrorists?
One could argue that. I'm not going to try to represent his perspective on the show, but that was my rebuttal to him is that, you know, what he is suggesting is that it's a classic case of blame the victim. You know, she was wearing a dress that was too provocative. Oh, you guys
right.
are behaving, you know, in a way that upset them. And so they committed a horrific crime. And so you should stop behaving that way. And I say, hey, stop committing horrific crimes. Spot on, George. Thank you very much. Len in New York City. Hey, Len.
Hi. First question. Did you get invited on any right-wing talk shows to talk about your cracking the code?
No. I've been invited, you know, I've been on Fox a lot in the morning show, and there's been a couple of times I've been invited and handing combs and whatnot that I've just turned down, but by and large, no.
Yeah, my point is that you guys were talking about marginalizing the radicals, making them irrelevant.
Yeah.
And I would suggest that even though he's a very nice, polite, well-dressed guy, he's someone who shouldn't be invited on. You know, he's one of those guys who should be marginalized because, I mean, you don't...
Here's the problem, Len. I'm not the mainstream media and don't represent it. And the mainstream media is giving voice to the Dinesh D'Souzas of the world constantly. They are constantly there. That perspective, I mean, just again today, you know, this whole thing about, John McCain, he's a tough guy and that's going to scare the world. And so they won't hit us again. Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, it works really well to terrify people, and then it doesn't, is the bottom line. And so I think it's very important that somebody be talking back to them. And if it's not going to happen in the mainstream media, it's going to happen on this show, because it's just, I've had enough of it. I've heard enough of it, and somebody needs to be talking back. Somebody needs to be saying, okay, here are the rebuttal points. If this does need to be rebutted. Carolyn Frederick is on the line with us. She's the director of the ACLU in the Washington, D.C. Legislative Office, ACLU.org, of course, the website. Speaking as a card-carrying member of the ACLU, Carolyn, let me welcome you to our program.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be on.
Thank you. Tell us about this, what do they call it, Bush and Friends Amnesty Law? Protect... Yeah, Protect Bush and Buddies Act, isn't that?
Yeah, it's the Get Out of Jail Free Card.
There you go.
Amendments of 2008.
Yeah. What's going on?
Well, right now the Senate is rushing to put its rubber stamp on the president's warrantless wiretapping program, and in addition, to give a special gift to their favorite campaign contributors and President Bush's dear friends, the telecommunications companies, that willy-nilly and in violation of the law turned over customer data to our spying agencies.
Is that what it came down to? I mean, we have 30 Democrats and one independent, Bernie Sanders, who voted to shoot down the immunity for these corporations. All of them Democrats and Bernie who caucuses with them. But that means that there was another roughly 20 Democrats who said, we'll go over to the dark side.
That's right.
And you're suggesting that it was just because they're getting campaign contributions?
No, not certainly not only. Although I would say one thing about the way that Washington works, which is there are certain people whose voices are louder than others.
Yeah.
They have more access. They're the ones, you know, guess what? Every senator takes a meeting with the head of AT&T or Verizon or any of those companies. And they see them after hours as well. They see them at their campaign finance lunches. They see them at the dinners and receptions and ski trips and everything else. So it may not be so much that they necessarily, you know, bought and paid for this particular vote, but they were able to raise these issues repeatedly in a very secure setting. But I think it's also that the president has gone to the mat for these companies. He has somehow gotten Democrats, certainly the number that you named, the 20 or so, to believe that giving these folks an opportunity to break the law somehow keeps us safer.
Well, he's gone to the mat for himself in that regard, because if there were ever trials of these folks, what would come out is the fact that he authorized
this. That's right.
And
that's absolutely right.
I mean, this is, more than anything else, this is the Don't Investigate and Prosecute the Bush Administration Act.
That's right, and I think it's really unfortunate that Democrats are buying into that. I mean, we really, you know, what we're doing right now is we're setting a precedent that The president can go demand some company or some individual break the law, and then they'll just fix it afterwards. They'll just change the law and then give them immunity after the fact. And I think, you know, unfortunately for the rest of us, the law doesn't work that way. If you break the law, you got to pay your penalties. You're going to go to jail or you've got to pay some massive fine. It's not as if somehow somebody's going to come along and change the law for your benefit and get you off the hook. But that's what we have Congress doing right now.
Here in the Pacific Northwest, Ron Wyden voted yes to prosecute, basically. You know, the yes votes were to strip the immunity out. And good on him. And Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray in Washington State voted the right way on this thing. Gordon Smith, obviously, the Republican, voted no. Now is the time, I guess, for people to call their senators and say, okay, now we know where you stand. We're sick of it.
That's right. People should call their senators and tell them to vote no on final passage, but then call your House members and tell them not to take up this bad Senate bill.
Don't let it go through conference.
Don't let it go through.
Brilliant. Carolyn Frederick, ACLU.org. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Tom Hartman Program reminding you that democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there and get active. Like, call your senator right now. Call Congress.org. We'll give you all the toll-free numbers to give him a call. We'll see you tomorrow. Oh, tag, you're it!
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.